A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Coming up in just a matter of moments, we're going to talk with our friend Jim Garrity from National Review Online. Now, I confess, when I reached out to Jim Monday afternoon, I said, well, you know, let's come on and talk about the Iowa caucuses. Figuring that we would have some results from the Iowa caucuses on Tuesday morning to talk about. Unfortunately, given the snafus that took place during the caucus on Monday evening, I don't have any results to tell you as we are taping this program. But we do know enough, I think, to talk about, generally speaking, how Iowa's caucuses went and what that means looking ahead for the Democratic presidential campaigns of individuals like Michael Bloomberg, the anti-gun billionaire who is hoping to buy his way into the White House. So without any further ado, take a look and a listen to our conversation with Jim Garrity from National Review Online. Jim, thank you, sir, for coming on the program. It's good talking with you today.
Cam, I always enjoy it. And boy, what a morning we're having.
So as we're recording this, and I've learned here with Bearing Arms, Cam and Company, that it's really tough to cover breaking news just because there's a little bit of lag time in uploading the show, and then people watch it over the course of a day or two. So I try not to cover breaking news, and I did not think that this would be breaking news. I figured when you and I talked Monday afternoon, I said, hey, you want to come on Tuesday morning and talk about the Iowa caucuses? I figured we'd have results, but I, as I'm recording this, I'm looking here, and 0% reporting as of 10 a.m. Eastern time. We have no results from the Iowa caucuses. What happened? What went wrong?
Yeah. So it appeared, by the way, it's worth noting, so as of this recording, we are approaching 10 o'clock on Tuesday. As you said, there's zero. Now, the caucus itself went on, the voting process seemed without a hitch, although it's worth noting the caucuses are complicated. Cam, I don't know about you. I am not a fan of this process. I like primaries. Everybody shows up when they want to show up. They vote. They go home. They decide to watch the returns on TV at night, and everything goes fine. Caucuses, as your listeners probably know, are at a particular time. I believe it was 7:30 local time. Everybody goes, shows up at their, you know, high school gymnasium or church basement or whatever facility is big and able to handle a bunch of people. People stand in corners. They say, all right, supporters of Joe Biden, you go stand over here. Supporter of Elizabeth Warren, you go over here. Supporters of Michael Bennett. Oh, we don't have any. Okay, don't have to worry about that. And the idea is, you know, you go there, everybody counts up their you know, how many's in each group. You count up how many people are total. And if your candidate has less than 15%, the candidate's out. And so you basically, those of you who are in that group have a couple options. You can say, well, I really was a Andrew Yang guy, and I don't like any of these other candidates, so I'm going home. Or you can say, you know what? Of the people who are left or above 15%, I like that guy or that gal. I'm going to go caucus with them. And if you have multiple candidates who are under 15%, you can say, you know what? We're all getting together. We're going to merge into one larger force like Voltron, and we're going to they can be undecided. There were a couple of people at a couple of locations last night, Cam, who said they would caucus for Cory Booker, the New Jersey senator. Now, you may have noticed Cory Booker quit the race on January 13th.
Right.
And yet, people are like, well, that's the kind of candidate we wish was still around, so we're going to caucus for him. So as far as I know, Cam, as of this hour, I believe Cory Booker got two delegates. Not out of the total statewide, but at two locations, one of the delegates allocated to that location got, in two places, Cory Booker had it. So by a lot of Sanders camp, last night was the best night for Cory Booker's campaign in a really long time. Talk about beating expectations, you know.
He's back. The big mo.
I mean, you also could theoretically caucus for undecided. One of the interesting things is once you hit 15% and you are on the undecided caucus, you have to stay there, apparently. You can't decide later in the night you want to switch or something like that. So
this is so confusing.
It is so confusing, and it's at least everyone showed up and seemed to be going fine. And I remember watching on C-SPAN years ago, you had one guy who was in charge, they tabulate all the votes, they figure out how it's split, how many delegates go to each candidate, and they call this to the central, you know, state committee in Des Moines, and they say, all right, this is how much we have. And I remember, you know, C-SPAN used to follow people around with cameras, and they would do it by payphone. It's kind of this, and there's all of this, like, notions of romance about the Iowa caucuses. By the way, they've only been doing this since like the 1970s. This is not going back to Abraham Lincoln tradition or right. anything like that.
Oh, so, those halcyon days of disco. Yes.
Yeah. And I guess the idea is, you know, because those of us who are in the other, I'm going to say 49 states, but let's face it, New Hampshire gets a pretty sweet deal. Nevada gets a nice amount of say. South Carolina, you know, after the first four, it really starts narrowing down. So those of us, like 46 other states, are like, you've got to be kidding me. All of these people over here, because you'll hear Iowans say, I really don't know who to vote for. I've only met them two or three times. And, you know, Cam, I don't know about you, but in my neck of the woods, the entirety of the campaign is entirely, I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I approve this message.
Right. Well, so let's talk about that for a second, because as we don't have any official results, mm-hmm. one of the storylines that is coming out of the precincts where there were reporters on the ground and they were able to, you know, kind of see what was going on is that it looks like this was not a good night for Joe Biden.
No. And again, there's some couple people who are arguing, well, look, you look at where, you know, the cable networks had chosen to set up their cameras. A lot of cities, a lot of college towns. You know, generally it was older and more rural Democrats were considered, you know, with the backbone of Biden's support in the state. So, you know, it's possible there's a little bit of a skewed effect from where people are looking and where the most coverage was.
Mm-hmm.
That having been said, I think there was one in a college town that was on CNN last night that I was watching where Biden came in at 3.3%.
Wow.
That's bad, right? And again, you know, and it was, you know, again, will it balance out? Of course, Bernie did well. Of course, Warren did well. And I think Yang was up there, you know, but like really, there were a bunch of places that anecdotally, it looked like Joe Biden was having a really rough night. And the other great thing, while we're on the topic of things not working the way they're supposed to because of incompetence and or technology, you know, to the extent people were paying attention this weekend, just heading into the Super Bowl weekend, the Des Moines Register, the biggest newspaper in the state, traditionally does a very, you know, respected poll that's generally pretty close to what it was. And they were supposed to release it Saturday night, and all of a sudden they said, wait, we can't. At least one person who was interviewed for the poll, they didn't list all the candidates, and they left off Pete Buttigieg, since I keep mispronouncing it as Boot at Edge. And then, so apparently, well, they basically said, we can't release the poll. We're not sure if it was done properly. We think it may, you know, we don't know if it's a fair poll because we may not have listed all the candidates for all the respondents. That was pretty shocking.
Yeah, it was.
And apparently the explanation that came on was that, well, they decided to enlarge the font size on their screen, and Buttigieg was at the bottom of the page, and the person who was doing the call didn't see it. Again, you know, when they say systems are foolproof, Cam,
right.
There are a lot of fools out there who can, you know, say, oh, you think it's foolproof? Hold my beer. I'm going to show you.
Exactly. You know, in the app that they're using there that they used in Iowa that apparently gave them all kinds of problems, I from what I understand, this same app is going to be used in Nevada, which I imagine has a lot of Democrats in that state a little nervous today. But I'm curious, you know, let's say that Biden does not perform well when we finally do get these results. What kind of opening do you think that gives Mike Bloomberg, Jim? You know, because clearly, if you look at the polling, there was a poll that came out this past week, I think that had Bloomberg in third place. Mm-hmm. And when you looked at the crosstabs, it was basically on the strength of voters over the age of 50 and really voters over the age of 65, kind of, you know, in Biden's lane. Right. I don't think there are too many Bernie Sanders supporters who are backing Mike Bloomberg as their second choice. You know, and so Bloomberg's competing for Biden's share of the vote. If Biden does not perform well in Iowa, he's been behind in New Hampshire in the polling to Bernie Sanders. Does this give Bloomberg the opening to say, look, Biden's damaged goods. I'm the establishment candidate. And what do you make of the DNC changing the rules to put Michael Bloomberg on the debate stage?
Yeah. On that one, I'll take it in reverse order.
Sure.
On the one hand, it felt a little weird to have Bloomberg, who was running ahead of certain candidates, not on the debate stage. And because the DNC, again, every effort the Democratic National Committee and the state parties have done to make the process, quote unquote, more fair, tends to create new headaches, right? Mm-hmm. Their idea of making sure everybody had a shot was to say, well, you don't just have to do well in the polls. You can also get in if you have a certain number of donations from across the country, and they gradually increase that. And that's why you saw candidates getting really desperate before the deadline and all of that. Look, if he's considering how where he is in the poll, and because Mike Bloomberg, being the multi-billionaire that he is like, I'm not taking any donations. So I can't meet the donation criteria because I'm not even bothering with that stuff. Mike Bloomberg is looking pretty smart right now because everyone said, oh my goodness, are you kidding me? You're skipping Iowa. You're not paying much attention to New Hampshire. You're not paying much attention to Nevada and South Carolina. And you're betting all your chips on the Super Tuesday state. You fool, that could never work. And one of the reasons I think people were skeptical was that back in 2008, that was the Rudy Giuliani strategy. He didn't think, you know, none of the early states looked great for him. He was like, I'm going to wait for Florida. Florida's going fifth. I'm going to make a big burst there. And the problem is that when you have four consecutive contests where you're not even in the discussion, people forget about you. People conclude, all right, I'm not interested in this guy. This guy's not running a serious campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's fair, maybe it's not. But each time you win, it generates some momentum. And the person who should be spitting hot fire today is probably Bernie Sanders, who, you know, feels like you. The whole reason they're having this complicated new technological app cam is that last time around, I could tell you exactly how many people, and in today's Morning Jolt newsletter, I can tell you exactly how many people voted for Ted Cruz, who won the Iowa caucus 4 years ago. I can tell you exactly how many people voted for Donald Trump 4 years ago and everybody else. The Republican Party recorded everybody's vote, regardless of whether they were above a 15% threshold or not when they first went in. Okay, the Democrats did not. And people may remember it was very, very close between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders last time. A couple of precincts came down to coin tosses. Last night, a couple of precincts came down to coin tosses. But, you know, Bernie Sanders and his supporters were saying, well, wait a second. We know it was close, but it's possible at each one of these precincts, we had a little bit more than everything else. And at each precinct, you add it all up. We could have won by a, you know, if we had the exact vote totals, a margin that would suggest we were running a stronger campaign and that we were the true winners of Iowa. But the Iowa Democrats didn't record everybody's first preference. They only record the delegates that everybody's getting from one. So this time around, they're like, okay, we got to do this. You know, we realize this is unfair. We realize this generates suspicion and conspiracy theories. We're going to say we're going to record everybody's vote when they come in, their first preference. We're going to record where everybody is after that 15% threshold, and then we're going to add up all the delegates, and then we're going to have the final winners and percentages and all that kind of stuff. They were going to have three or four different, totals taken at different stages. Again, this is why primaries look so nice and simple, you know.
Yeah.
But it's one of the great ironies is that this was done in response to complaints from Bernie Sanders last time. And one that I think, that, you know, whatever you think of Bernie Sanders' politics, the idea that, oh, we don't know how many people voted, it's really not the kind of answer you want to hear when you're doing a primary contest. And so... that's, you know, this was an attempt. Now, if anecdotally, based on what we were seeing on last night on the cable news as they were reporting live from various locations across the state, it looked like Bernie Sanders was having a really good night. I, you know, based on that, I would have said, okay, Bernie Sanders looks like he's winning. Warren had a better night than it seemed to be expected. Buttigieg seemed to be having a better night than seemed to be expected. And then maybe Klobuchar was having an okay night. Ironically, Biden, you know, coming in fourth or fifth, Biden is the establishment candidate. He's got money. He's got name recognition. He's been the national frontrunner for most of the year. He can survive a bad night. I don't know if he can survive two or three consecutive bad nights. And that's when you might see the establishment saying, all the kind of nervous comments we heard from John Kerry this past weekend. You know, the establishment is suddenly realizing Biden is kind of this like self-sustaining perception of frontrunnerdom. A front-runner status.
Mm-hmm.
And once you take that away from him, does everybody come off the bandwagon all at once? And does everybody jump to Buttigieg? Does everybody jump to Bloomberg? You know, the Biden campaign could be in really, you know, very shaky shape as we head into New Hampshire. And one of the great ironies is if he was going to have a collapse, all year long, Democrats have been saying Biden's going to collapse and Deval Patrick will be, you know, well-suited to pick him up. I'm sure Cory Booker thought maybe Kamala Harris, a whole bunch of these candidates said Biden's going to collapse and all of his supporters are going to be looking for somebody new to go to and I'm going to be that candidate. And for almost all of 2019, Biden hung on. And now is the voting starting. All of a sudden, now the wheels are coming off the bus.
Yeah, and we'll see, we'll see where those voters go if, in fact, Biden does collapse. But I one final question for you. You know, clearly Bloomberg thinks that that puts him in the catbird seat here. I'm curious. I mean, do you think, let's say, Jim, that Bloomberg manages to, you know, get to a contested convention. He ends up, the victor in a bitter, acrimonious floor fight. Or heck, even Biden. Let's say Biden gets the nomination, or Sanders. I mean, you just look at the deep divisions within the Democratic Party right now. And I know that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out yesterday and said, well, you know, we have to support whoever the candidate is. I think that's a lot easier said than done on the left, given the deep ideological divide that we see between some of these candidates.
Yeah. Yesterday in the Morning Jolt, I had thought through how each campaign was going to respond to each outcome. And I kind of wrote the preemptive spin for everybody, hitting people's email boxes Monday morning. Cam, I did not predict we have no results. I didn't have spin for this one. And I'm sorry, Iowa Democratic Party. There is no spin for this situation. But I also went for, like, what's the Trump response? And one of them is that, you know, there's not a lot that unites Mike Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders. They just have completely different ideas about what the economy needs, what the country needs, what traits a manager should have, what traits a president. Like, they're just totally different. And you can put almost everybody else. The kind of the Bernie bros are not going to be that into Amy Klobuchar, right? Mm-hmm. The Elizabeth Warren, you know, diversity management coordinators at universities are not going to be thrilled if Biden is the nominee, Mr. Gaffomatic, and, you know, talking about how he works for segregationists and all that stuff. The Democrats believe that they're in a strong position for 2020 because there are a whole bunch of Americans across a whole bunch of different wide spectrum of beliefs and ideas and demographics who don't like Trump. And that's true as far as it goes. But at some point, you got to nominate somebody. And that somebody is going to be deeply disappointing to one of those demographics. Now, will it be enough to get them to stay home? I don't know. Will it be enough to get them to vote third party? I don't know. We'll get some of them to, you know, to flip sides and say, no, I prefer Trump. I don't know. You hear talk at Wall Street says that, you know, in a choice between Sanders and or Warren against Trump, they would back Trump.
Mm-hmm.
There are some demographics. The suburban soccer moms are probably not really itching for a giant socialist revolution. The Democrats have a really wide range, and at some point you kind of wonder, is there someone who can unite all these factions? And I think the answer is no. And so the question is, okay, who does the best job of uniting all of these factions? And I think it's still a very open question. But, you know, Greg, I'm sorry, God, you can tell how many podcasts I do in a day. I'm sorry, Cam. Cam, my good friend. Of going up on to 16 years now. Clearly, we know who unites this party the most. We just have to look at the Iowa caucus results.
On that, we will let you go. Thank you so much, Jesse Kelly. And I'm sorry. Jim Garrity, thank you very much for your insight and your analysis, my friend. I appreciate it and I look forward to hopefully seeing you in a couple of weeks. I'll be coming up for CPAC 2020. So hopefully I'll see you there in the D.C. area.
I look forward to that, Cam. And I just want to point out, you know, as bad as this was, this is not the worst possible situation to yell out the rhyme.
That is very, very true. And I can't imagine we'd ever find ourselves in that other situation. But all right, we'll leave it there. Jim Garrity from National Review joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. So it is going to be a little bit of time before we actually see whether or not Michael Bloomberg is benefiting from Joe Biden's apparent struggles. Now, again, keep in mind, you know, some of the polling can be way off. I mean, if the results are to be believed, or at least the anecdotal results are to be believed, Biden apparently was over polling in Iowa. Although, again, we'll wait and we'll see what the final vote suggests. In New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders has been sort of running away with it. Biden is generally in second place. And by quite a few points there in New Hampshire. It's not until you get down to like South Carolina, where Biden, again, according to the scant polling that we've seen, enjoys some real support. If Biden tanks in these early contests, which is exactly what Michael Bloomberg is hoping for, he will try to take advantage of that on Super Tuesday, which is coming up. I believe that's March 3rd or 4th. And that's where you got, you know, I think it's 14 different states, including Texas, California. There are a ton of delegates that are up for grabs. And Bloomberg's whole game plan right now is predicated on the idea that Joe Biden is going to tank in these early contests, and that when given the opportunity, the quote-unquote moderate Democrats are going to embrace a Bloomberg candidacy instead of going to Klobuchar or Buttigieg or Andrew Yang, even, right? Meanwhile, over on the far left wing of the party, you've still got that battle between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren that'll be taking place. I suspect that Sanders is going to win that fight, but because there is that deep divide even on the far left, it's really tough to get that one unifying candidate. If Elizabeth Warren were to win, for example, as Jim pointed out, there are a lot of folks on Wall Street who said, well, I'd back Donald Trump. There are some Bernie Sanders supporters who I don't think would back Elizabeth Warren. If Bernie Sanders wins, I think there's some Elizabeth Warren supporters who'd have a difficult time backing Bernie. And then, of course, the Biden supporters, the Bloomberg supporters, would they back a Democratic socialist? It's from a political perspective, it's fascinating to watch. From the perspective of an American gun owner who's concerned about their rights being stripped, it's just like watching a slow motion train wreck unfold, because there is no pro-gun candidate, whether it's on the far left, whether it's on the quote unquote moderate left. They're all in favor of turning our rights into privileges. And so there's really nobody to root for. You're just sort of I'm sort of rooting for as chaotic a process as we can possibly see. And so far, so good in Iowa anyway. All right, let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day. I love this good deed of the day story, I got to tell you. And our recidivism report, which I don't like, but we'll share with you anyway, because these are the types of things that happen each and every day in our court system involving violent criminals who go on to repeat crime after crime after crime, do very little time for those crimes. All the while, lawmakers are looking at you and me and other legal gun owners and say, well, there's the problem right there. So Maine, where a pair has been charged with the death of a Maine man. They've pleaded guilty to, not guilty rather, to a murder and arson. Both of these gentlemen have fairly lengthy criminal histories. The Joseph J.J. Johnson and Cote Chineska, arrested back in December for the murder of 59-year-old Burton Conley, who was killed and then his home was set on fire. The pair apparently told police that they had been to Conley's home back on November the 1st to buy drugs. They said that they left and returned home about 2 a.m., and had nothing to do with the murder and the fire. Police disagree. The two were arrested in early December. Both, according to WGME, have lengthy criminal histories. Cote Chineska was sentenced in 1998 to 30 years in prison for manslaughter for the death of a Clifton store owner who was shot six times. Now, manslaughter, I don't know why manslaughter, not first degree murder. The owner survived. I guess that would be why. I didn't realize you could charge somebody with manslaughter when the person was alive. There you go. Owner survived, left partially paralyzed and in a wheelchair. So again, 30-year prison sentence 22 years ago. 12 years of that 30-year sentence was suspended. So Chineska was supposed to do 18 years, right? 1998, carry the one. 2016 is when he should have been released from prison. He was not. He was released on Christmas Eve 2012, and he completed his probation last year, which is, again, when you have a suspended sentence, supposedly that's supposed to last over the course of your probation, but it didn't here. J.J. Johnson, according to WGME, a longer but less violent criminal history that dates back to 2005. Drunk driving, drug trafficking, criminal mischief, violations of bail, probation conditions. No violent crime up until the crime that he is accused of. As WGME says, if convicted of murder, Johnson and Chinesca face between 25 years to life in prison. They face up to 30 years in prison if convicted of arson. And again, I think there's a really good case to be made that at least one of those suspects, Mr. Chinesca, should not have been on the streets to begin with. He should have been behind bars serving his sentence for manslaughter. Now, on to our armed citizen story of the day. Clay County, Kentucky, where a suspected burglar held at gunpoint by homeowners until police were able to show up. This from WAVE-TV. 34-year-old Jonathan Sizemore. That's the mugshot of Mr. Sizemore. Arrested on charges of burglary as well as public intoxication. Never a smart idea to get drunk and break into somebody's home. It was about 8 o'clock Sunday night there in Clay County. WKYT reported homeowners called police, let them know that they were holding Sizemore at gunpoint after catching him on their property burglarizing their outbuilding. Homeowners continued to hold Sizemore at gunpoint until officers arrived. Sheriff's office says that Sizemore showed signs of intoxication, later admitted to police that he was on meth. It's an even worse idea than getting drunk and trying to burgle somebody's home, getting high on meth, and, well, let's just leave it there, just getting high on meth. That's just a really, really awful idea. Sizemore arrested, booked at the Clay County Detention Center. Court date has not yet been set. Homeowners not facing any problems because they were well within their rights to do so. And today's good deed of the day, also from Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, where a Louisville police officer in his spare time is saving dogs from kill shelters and finding them forever homes. This is from WHAS. Robert Yoshioka is an officer for the Louisville, Kentucky Police Department. He actually lives in southern Indiana, Jeffersonville, Indiana. He's the president of a group called Chibi's Furins. Yes. Furins. Like friends, but furry friends. It is a nonprofit group. Its goal is to save dogs from high kill shelters in Kentucky and southern Indiana. And to place those dogs with folks who will keep them for the remainder of their lives. Yoshioka owns 5 dogs. He says 4 of them are foster fails. He said there are so many dogs out there, they need help. And so Chibi's Furins works with groups like Shelter Love, Pet Finder, PetSmart Charities to get the word out about dogs that need homes. They provide resources like dog food donations. The nonprofit provides food, crates, toys to anybody who volunteers to foster a dog. They make sure that the dogs are up to date on shots. They make sure that the dogs are microchipped. And last year, more than 60 dogs were actually adopted through this nonprofit group, Chibi's Furins. Officer Yoshioka says it's helpful. He said people really appreciate when they have a pet, so it's a good feeling. He says dogs can't help themselves, so I do like helping. Right now, they are hoping to be able to find homes for 100 dogs in 2020. If you would like to help them out, you can simply go to the website, Chibi's Furins, Furinds, chibisfurins.org. And in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to help out some good boys and girls. Officer Yoshioka there in Louisville, Kentucky, we thank you for your very, very good deeds. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Thank you for being a part of the program today. Coming up tomorrow, we will have hopefully some results from Iowa to talk about, as well as a look ahead at gun bills coming up this Friday in Virginia. This is basically the last chance for Democrats to start moving legislation out of the House of Origin and to get those bills crossed over. We're going to be taking a close look at House Bill 961, Governor Northam's gun ban bill, which so far is in limbo, doesn't look good, and that's great news for gun owners. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company.